By What's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Voters in Colombia narrowly rejected a peace deal with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia in a referendum on Sunday, delivering a stunning blow to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who acknowledged the defeat after the no side had received 50.2% of the vote. Pre-election polling predicted it would go the other way. Peter Hockham is a senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue.
Clearly, the polling was inaccurate. And if you look at where the votes, clearly the peace won yes to the peace treaty, won in most of the larger cities, many of the coastal areas. It was in the mountainous central part of Colombia that it lost.
Opponents of the peace deal, focused their criticism on provisions which would have reintegrated the rebels into Colombian society and guaranteed them seats in the legislature in exchange for themselves into a political party. Gabon's prime minister has named a new government in the wake of disputed elections won by incumbent President Ali Bongo. No representative of the opposition led by Jean Ping are in the new government. Ping says he does not recognize Bongo's legitimacy to lead the country. Syrian rebels and pro-government forces clashed Sunday on several fronts around Aleppo as the country's military command called on militants to lay down their weapons and evacuate the contested city. The government's attempt to penetrate Aleppo's opposition-held eastern side has been accompanied by a relentless campaign of airstrikes by Russian and Syrian warplanes, estimated 275,000 people trapped. This is VOA News. Afghan officials say the Taliban has launched a coordinated attack on Kunduz in the northeastern part of the country. A spokesman for the Kunduz provincial government said that Afghan forces had repelled today's attack. Taliban claims to have taken control of several checkpoints in Kunduz, which was overrun by the Taliban in September of last year, the first time the militants had taken a major urban center since launching their insurgency 15 years ago. British Prime Minister Theresa May says the UK will formally start the process of leaving the European Union by the end of March. Before Sunday's announcement, May had only said that Britain would not trigger Article 50 of EU's Lisbon Treaty before the end of the year. Article 50 is the treaty clause that would start a two-year countdown for Britain's formal exit. Prime Minister said, now the discussion begins about the future.
We're going to talk about global Britain, our ambitious vision for Britain after Brexit. Because 100 days ago, that is what the country voted for. We're going to talk about Britain, in which we are close friends, allies and trading partners with our European neighbours, but a Britain in which we pass our own laws and govern ourselves.
In the run-up to Britain's referendum on whether to remain in the European Union, opponents of Brexit warned that leaving the bloc would lead to economic peril, but the country's economy appears to have performed strongly since the vote, undermining predictions of gloom and doom. Hurricane Matthew is moving toward densely populated Jamaica and Haiti, unleashing winds that could destroy homes, down power lines, and cause torrential rains. Landslides and floods would be likely. As the Caribbean's worst storm in nearly a decade, Matthew has topped winds of 230 kilometers per hour. Cuba also in the path of the Category 4 hurricane. President Raul Castro traveled to the southeastern city of Santiago to oversee emergency operations just before the hurricane was due to hit. Odalis Colon lives in Santiago. She said what must be preserved now is life. She said material things can gain are good, but not as good as life. On its current track, Matthew's center will glance past Jamaica later today, dumping heavy rain as it makes landfall then on Haiti, then head to Cuba. Meteorologists have said it's possible the hurricane could eventually track near the U.S. East Coast, brushing the state of Florida.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
accuses Ethiopia's government of culpability in the death Sunday of more than 50 people.
This is one of the darkest days in modern Oromo history, where more than 100 people were massacred in one place, in one small city, in one day.
Merara Gudina is the chairman of the Oromo Federalist Congress. The Ethiopian government blames what it calls disrupting forces for Sunday's stampede, resulting in the death of more than 50 people. Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye is expected to return home today from a visit to Europe and North America, but the police have a warning for his supporters.
At the moment, there is only one president, and who is the sovereign authority of Uganda, and you don't have any other president. And anybody who attempts to claim he is a president, he or she must know that it's illegal and it is treasonous.
Andrew Kawisi is the new Ugandan police spokesman. The family of a dead South Sudanese journalist said he was murdered. South African students discover a way to reduce maize toxin, and Malawi girls learn self-defense tactics against sexual abuse. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Ethiopia, one of the leaders of the Oromo people is accusing the Ethiopian government of culpability in an incident Sunday that resulted in the death of 52 people. Thousands of people had gathered in the town of Bishuftu to celebrate the Oromo Festival of Thanksgiving. For the past 2 years, the Oromo people have been protesting against the government over land and lack of representation. Merera Gudina, chairman of the Oromo Federalist Congress, says everything was going fine until government officials came, took over the stage, and started making speeches in support of the government. He said when the crowds rejected the government speeches, security forces began firing on the crowds using live bullets and tear gas, resulting in a stampede.
You know, what happened is that the government tried to take over the event, which is one of the most popular Oromo cultural events, where billions of people converge in one small city called Bishuftu. The government tried to use the festival to promote its narrow political agenda, which people opposed to it. And when the government supporters start to talk, the people oppose to them. And then the government security people start to shoot at people using live bullets and then tear gas, which led to a very chaotic situation where not less than 100 people said to be died.
You said the government tried to change the festivities. How did the government try to change the festivities?
For example, it brought several thousands of its own supporters trying to take over the stage where the festivity was being conducted, trying to plant its own flag, trying to make a speech that supports the government policies and so on. So, in fact, the government tried to take over the whole process of the festivity by deploying the security personnel, including the police, the federal police, the army. So the government, in fact, trying to totally to take over the festivity.
The government is blaming outsiders who, it said, were organized to interrupt the celebration.
You know, the millions of people who were around there, you know, who were attending, they simply said, don't change our cultural festivity, our cultural festival, to promote your narrow political agenda. It is the government which organized its own supporters, brought its own supporters from all over the place and tried to use it. It is not the opposition. You know, the opposition simply, you know, the young people, ordinary citizens, they opposed what the government tried to do, to take over their cultural festivity. It is the government who started it. The opposition leaders were not there.
So what can you tell us? How many people were killed?
Even the government, you know, admitted that 52 people died, and the government itself declared that 3 days of mourning. So there is no debate about the killing, but the number, the social media people are putting around 300. And the eyewitnesses who were able to count some are telling us more than 100. Some say 120, 150, 250. Even the government admitted it. They declared a national mourning for 3 days. This is one of the darkest days in modern Oromo history, where more than 100 people were massacred in one place, in one small city, in one day.
I know there's been some trouble in the Oromia region. What do the people there want?
The issues are many, from land grab to self-rule to, you know, many things. Simply, the Oromo people are fed up of the regime, fed up of its policies, fed up of empty promises. The part of the regime, the part of the government, a political group called the PIO, which is trying to represent the Oromos. They are not representing our people. Our people are against this group and simply saying they should go. The people say, we did not elect you. You should go, and you are not representing anybody. That is what the people want. You know, change of policies, change of regime, change of, you know, their own lives, you know, which is terrific. So the issues are many, but the central issue is that the people want to rule themselves, to govern themselves, for the respect of their own democratic rights, their human rights. All these are violated by the regime in power, which is a dictatorial regime, always rigging massively elections to stay in power. So the people are against most of the things the present regime is undertaking. Anyway, the people think the present regime is not representing them, not elected by them. That is a problem.
Merera Gudina is the chairman of the Oromo Federalist Congress. He is also vice chair of the largest opposition coalition called the MEDREC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa.
ነውጠኛ ኃይሎች አስቀድሞ ስፍራ ይዞ በመቆየታቸውና ይሄን በአል ለማወቅ አቅደው.
The Ethiopian government is blaming what it calls disrupting forces for Sunday's stampede that resulted in the death of more than 50 people. Government figures say as many as 52 people died on Sunday from a stampede during festivities marking the Oromo Thanksgiving in the town of Bishuftu, about 25 miles south of the capital, Addis Ababa. Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn said forces bent on disrupting the celebrations were already in place prior to the start of the event. He said as they tried to enact their plan, chaos ensued among those invited for the celebrations. The Prime Minister confirmed that as many as 52 people were killed and many more wounded. An Oromo opposition leader told VOA security forces that began firing and using live bullets and tear gas, resulting in stampede.
Mengistim እንደዚህ አይነት እኩይ ተግባር የሚያከናውኑትን ወደ ህግ አቅርቦ የሚያስጠይቃቸው ነው ስለዚህም.
But Prime Minister Desalegn denied security forces fired on the crowds. He said security forces tried hard to maintain order peacefully without firing a single bullet. He called on the Oromo people to denounce all acts of violence and promised that those responsible for the chaos would be held accountable. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today is Monday, October 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Ugandan police have warned supporters of opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye that they will arrest and charge anyone who refers to Besigye as His Excellency, the People's President or President of Uganda. Dr. Besigye, who claims he won Uganda's February 2016 presidential election, is scheduled to return home today, Monday, after a month touring Europe and North America. Besigye, who, according to the Election Commission, came second in the poll, was released on bail in July after being charged with treason for declaring himself president following the election. Since then, his supporters have been referring to him as the People's President. Police spokesman Andrew Kawisi says the police have information that posters referring to Dr. Besigye as president are being distributed.
Well, I don't know how that heading came about. I had a press conference today. I was just cautioning the supporters who are calling him President of the Republic of Uganda. And I was reminding them that at the moment, there is only one president, and who is the sovereign authority of Uganda, and you don't have any other president. And anybody who attempts to claim he is a president he or should know that it's illegal and it is treasonous in nature, because he or she must know that it's illegal.
Mr. Kawisi, do you know if there are people who are carrying posters of Dr. Besigye describing him as the president or His Excellency?
Yes, there are quite a number of people who are doing that, and they were even hanging banners that they are welcoming the president of Uganda, the people's president, and the police was just cautioning them about the illegality of their activities and action.
Isn't that freedom of speech? I mean, somebody can call me president of the United States, but in reality, if I'm not the president, it doesn't bother me.
No, that is the United States. Maybe that's how it is. But here, if it is, you cannot proclaim yourself to be a president of Uganda. You can be a president of the Rotary Club, you can be a president of an organization, but you can't be a president of Uganda. We have the president of the ghetto clubs, we have so many presidents. The term president is used by many people, but does not refer to being head of state of Uganda.
Dr. Besigye has been out of the country. Are these posters about welcoming him back to Uganda? Is that correct?
Yes, they claim they want to welcome him as he comes back to Uganda, which is not a problem. He is returning to his country, and nobody has any issue about it. But the manner they should do it, he must be regulated. They must not form illegal processions. And generally, must work with the police. Must inform the police about whatever they intend to do to ensure that whatever they do is regulated for the good of others who are also living in the same country.
But Dr. Besigye was the presidential candidate of the Forum for Democratic Change. So one would assume that he still holds a very prominent position in that party. So what's wrong with his supporters welcoming him?
Nobody has stopped anyone to welcome him, but it must be done in a way that it does not disrupt public peace. And number two, Besigye is not a flag bearer anymore. The elections ended early this year, and the election results were declared by the authority that is mandated to do so. So he's a Ugandan and a member of his party. That's the status. And whoever wants to have any celebration with him has to follow the law. And the law on public order management is very clear on processions, on gatherings, on convoys. So what they have to do is to work with us and nothing else beyond that. And working with us, they should also be able to listen to our guidance and the guidelines given.
I'm assuming that the police will be present when Dr. Besigye does return to the country today, Monday.
Certainly, the police is present everywhere. And since we have got their plans, their planned activities, which seem to be bent towards causing disruptions, maybe also influencing some violent acts from the some groups of society, we shall be there and guide them and regulate their activities.
Andrew Kawisi is the new Ugandan police spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. The family of a South Sudanese journalist who was kidnapped in June and later found dead is speaking out about his death. Isaac Vuni's dead body was found dumped on a farm late last month. Family members say they believe he was murdered in cold blood. Wake Simon Wudu has more from Nairobi.
On June 4th, an unknown man in military uniform kidnapped Isaac Vuni from his home. He was not seen again until September 22nd, when his body was found in Kerepi near his ancestral village. Isaac Vuni's wife, who prefers to be identified by only her surname, Joa, for security reasons, says on that fateful day, six armed men came to the house and took away both her husband and his cousin.
Since that time, I was been communicating, trying to get information, but there is no person who is willing to give any information about it. I call, but there are people are saying they don't know what happened. So from there, I thought that maybe he might be maybe taken somewhere else. Throughout, we have been praying that maybe he will be alive somewhere else. But now, last week on Thursday, is when I was told that he was found dead in one of the community members' farm.
Joa says before her husband was killed, he had told her that some unidentified government officials had threatened him in connection with his journalistic work. The freelance journalist whose work was published in the Sudan Tribune, among other media outlets, left behind 7 children. Joa says she has no idea how she will provide for the children's needs. Joa says she will not even try to seek for justice because she does not believe justice will be served in South Sudan.
I cannot be able to get a justice to my husband because he just died in a cold blood. And I'm sure there are people who knew that this man is dead. Nobody wants to tell me. So who will I fight to get a justice?
Veteran South Sudanese journalist Alfred Taban, who is chairman of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, a media rights group, describes Voni as a good researcher who was dedicated to his profession.
He was committed to his work. Actually, he is one of those who started the Union of South Sudan, UJAW. He was a founding member, and at that time he was quite committed to his work. Although the SPLM had been accusing him of collaborating with the government in Khartoum. Well, we consider it very unfortunate. I mean, even if you disagree with somebody, it's not right to have him killed.
Voni rose to fame way back in 2008 when he reported about a financial scandal involving some members of the Sudan People's Liberation Army and some officials of the then semi-autonomous government of Southern Sudan. Voni was arrested and detained. Months later, he was released and then fled the country. Government officials deny they know anything about Voni's death. Akol Paul Kordit is South Sudan's deputy information minister.
The government of the Republic of South Sudan, the transitional government of national unity, is very clear on this issue that the right of opinion or expression is enshrined in our constitution.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says government must be transparent about the investigation into Voni's death. Last year, 7 journalists were killed in South Sudan, according to the committee. This year, at least 4 journalists have been killed, including 2 who were shot during the fighting in July. This year's Global Press Freedom Index, published by Reporters Without Borders, ranks South Sudan 140th out of 180 countries as the most dangerous countries for journalists. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
Maize was domesticated by the indigenous tribes in Mexico some 10,000 years ago. Today, it is a staple food around the world. But a fungus that contaminates the grain can pose serious health risks. Todd Grushins tells us about 2 South African students who are working to reduce that risk.
More maize is produced annually than any other grain on earth, and it's the most important cereal crop in sub-Saharan Africa. Maize, or corn as it's known in the United States, is susceptible to a type of mold called mycotoxin. The mold raises the risk of chronic diseases, including cancer. Now, South African high school students Kaliswa Nchinga and Yolanda Nkala say they can reduce mycotoxin in maize by 98%. Yolanda Nkala.
So with our experiment, we came up with 3 simple methods in which people can be able to use those methods at home, and that is to be able to visually sort the maize.
The young researchers have been working with scientists in South Africa, including Dr. Hester Berger.
This is quite incredible for us because we are always looking for sustainable, cultural, and sort of affordable methods to reduce mycotoxin exposure in rural areas.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
Schoolgirls in Malawi are learning what to do if someone tries to attack them. A Kenyan NGO started the training in response to a recent study that showed 1 in 5 girls under the age of 18 in Malawi has been sexually assaulted. Lamek Masina has the story from a school in the Salima district of central Malawi.
This is not a martial arts class, but these girls are learning how to defend themselves.
The curriculum involves both verbal and physical skills. With the physical skills, it's used only if it's the last and best option. So, meaning to say, we use mainly the verbal skills, which is how to use their voices to end assaults.
The girls learn to shout for help or pretend they see someone coming to fool their attacker. They also learn techniques to disable the attacker so they can run for safety. Instructors from the charity Ujama Pamoja Africa have been conducting these weekly two-hour lessons at schools in 7 districts around Malawi.
At the end of the year, we'd like to reduce the incidences of rape. We'd also like to promote education by reducing early marriages, school dropouts, and also early pregnancies.
The UN Children's Fund is financing the program. So far, 25,000 girls have taken part. Teachers say Ujama interventions have removed some of the stigma around sexual assault.
In the past, girls were not reporting it, but now they are indeed empowered to report abuses. Some are reporting the incidents to us teachers, and others to their parents for action.
And some girls say they have already had to use their skills.
My uncle ordered me to lie on his bed. When I asked why, he started touching my body. I told him to stop and that I will report him to police or my mother if he continues. After hearing this, he ordered me out of his room.
The Ujama Project is also teaching boys about respecting girls and teaching them how to intervene if they see a girl being assaulted. Fans permitting project organizers say they want to extend the self-defense program to students nationwide. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Salima, Malawi.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. An annual cultural event in the Oromia region of Ethiopia, attended annually by hundreds of thousands, turned deadly on Sunday when police fired tear gas and warning shots to disperse anti-government protesters. The tear gas caused a panic and triggered a stampede in Beshuftu, a town about 40 kilometers southeast of the capital, Addis Ababa, and local officials reported that 52 people were killed. But witnesses told VOA at least 100 lost their lives. The witnesses said those at the festival, known as Irisha, were angered during the speech of an Oromo traditional leader known as the Aba Gada and objected to the flag near the stage representing the Ethiopian government. A group of young people rushed the stage and tried to remove the flag, and security forces responded by beating the protesters. Soldiers fired tear gas and people panicked and ran for safety. In a statement broadcast on national television, Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn said the disruption was intentionally caused by people within the event who were seeking to cause chaos. He denied that government forces used live rounds. That's it for this Monday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very, very productive week.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.
Next on Let's Talk, we will talk about beads. Are they a symbol of beauty or an expression of culture? Why are they so famous among Africans? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing this colorful topic, beads. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.